Okay, we will just, for the sake of having the whole picture, I'm going to start again from Pasuk Yud Zayin, Perek Dalid Pasuk Yud Zayin. The army of Sisera was completely defeated. So we'll see quite how shocking this is. It's a little difficult for us to... I guess so. We'll get there. Probably not going to be this week. The army of Sisera is completely defeated. This was really a shocking event. We'll see later how shocking it was. But it was like saying, we gave the example the other day of a bunch of buses going out from Upper Chemish to go fight North Korea. Right? But we didn't tell the end of the story. The end of the story is at the end of the day, those buses came back and they said, oh, that's it. North Korea is emptied out. I mean, basically what happened, but here was actually, they came back, and that was it. The whole reality in Eretz Yisrael had changed. We'll see. We're going to focus on that more in the next parak. We're talking about a superpower that had been ruling Eretz Yisrael. These 10,000 people went out. They were looked at as nuts by many of the people around. And the next thing you knew, Sisera's entire army was defeated. Whatever it is, we're going to get more into that in the next parak. The next parak is going to go back and really analyze everything that happened here. But right now we're just telling the facts, the events. So we're going to start again from Pasuk Yud Zayin. Sisera's army is defeated. The Sisera Nos Beraglov, Sisera himself, the great mighty warrior, has just lost an army of hundreds of thousands. He's fleeing by foot. And we said last week, he was even scared to go in the direction. He saw that the defeat was going to be absolute. He didn't want to even run with his army. He knew they were going to get caught and wiped out. He ran in the other direction. El Oyel Yoel Eishes Chever Akeni. To the tent of Yoel, the wife of Chever Akeni, right? We said last week that they had set up their tent right near where the battle was going on beforehand, but they were situated there. Kisholim ben Yovin Melech Chatzor ben Beis Chever Akeni, because there was a peaceful relationship between Yovin, the king over Sisera, the king of Chatzor, and the house of Chever Akeni. Now, Vateitze Yael Likras Sisera, and Yael came out to greet Sisera. He's a fleeing fugitive right now, but this again is the basically the mightiest warrior in the world. And she said to him, Sura Adoni, come away, my master. Sura Elai, Al Tira, come away to me, don't be afraid. Vayasar Eleha Ehela, Vatechaser Basmicha. So he came away to her, and she covered him with a blanket. He was afraid. He was exhausted. He was defeated. And she was planning on doing what she was going to do. But if you have a small, petite woman, I don't know if she was petite, but she certainly wasn't anywhere near who Sisera was. We're talking about the mightiest warrior in the world. She had to make sure that he was, that this wasn't going to mess up. Otherwise, he'd squash her like a bug. So she had to make sure that he was sufficiently out of it before she'd be able to make her move. And therefore, as we discussed last week, and we're going to discuss it more in detail as we go along, she did whatever she could to exhaust him completely. So, actually, Chazal say that this pasuk is very faintly alluding at what actually went on here. Yael took a very, very unusual step, which we're going to discuss. And she decided that for this purpose, in order to ensure that he's as weak as he could possibly be, she actually seduced him. Talking about a married woman, and she actually seduced him, and not only that, she egged him on so much that Chazal say she got him into a craze, one time after the other. He was with her seven times. After that, he was spent. That was what Yael was getting. Now, how could she do this? We're going to say for the next parak. Was this justified? We'll save it for the next parak. Right now all we say is that this is what Chazal term Avera Lishma. an Avera done for the right purposes. Whether it's sanctioned. When it's sanctioned, we're going to wait. The Avera is going to give her analysis on the whole story here. Well, she'll do a better job than we will. We'll see. But meanwhile, this is what happens. So first of all, she knocks him out in this way. Right? Very friendly way. Next. And he tells her, "Hashkini no ma'atmayim, please give me some water to drink, tzameisi, because I'm thirsty." Vatiftach esnoid hecholo. So she opened the jar of water, of milk, vatashkeil, and she gave him to drink. She fed him davka milk. Why? Milk also will help with the drowsiness. She's trying to knock him out. She didn't give him wine because he asked for water. Wine would be a little bit too much of a contrast, but she was hoping that in his weary state, he wouldn't chop. And the truth is that that was what she was trying to test also. She wanted to see how alert he was. He asked for water, she gave him milk, which would help knock him out even more, and also she'd be able to test his alertness. This was all she was playing around with. She wanted to see, is the moment right? She gave him this milk and then she covered him again. By the way, it's just interesting to note, Ma'am Leia's notes, what's going on here, right? She covered him with the blanket, he peeps his head out, can I have some water? She gives him the milk and covers him again. And he was so furtive. Let's note, like we said earlier, this guy was the most arrogant guy in the world. This guy was walking around, talking big against Hashem. He was blaspheming against Hashem. We said that therefore he was destined to reach the most degrading end a warrior could reach in those days, to be killed by a woman. He isn't there yet, but he's getting there. But part of Hashem's point was, this guy was held himself at the top of the world, he's going to be taken all the way down to the lowest possible level of disgrace before he goes. So this is already manifesting here. Imagine this guy, the strongest guy in the world, most powerful guy in the world, the most fearless person in the world, is now reduced to hiding under a blanket, sticking his head out, asking for water, and he's so panicky that he needs her to quickly cover him again. He's like a frightened little mouse who's being cared for by this puny woman. That's the great mighty warrior. So again, Hashem is already starting the process of, before he's killed, he's going to be killed too, but before he's killed, he's being pushed down into the ground, but good. This guy had never experienced anything like this. Fine. After he was seduced. He probably would have picked up on that. I don't think he was looking to be knocked out. She gave him something that she could test if he's alert or not. Wine probably would have been a bit too much. Now, Vayomer Eleho, and he told her, Amoid Pesach Ha'oyel, stand at the entrance of the tent. Vayoyah, he knows that Barak is pursuing him and he's going to be looking for him. Vayoyah in Ish Yavoyush Eilech, the Oma Hayesh Ba'ish, and if somebody comes and asks, is there a man here? V'amat oin, say that there isn't. That's a simply understood, all he's saying is, say I'm not here. Well, we already saw the Mefarshim read two interesting, significant points into this. First of all, he said also Hashem was mamish playing games with Sisera at this point. And he was basically predicting what was going to be the reality. In about 2 minutes, Barak is going to show up, and she will honestly be able to say there's nobody here, because Barak, was Sisera by that time, was dead. So, that's what was going on here. But the Malbim, we quoted this last thing, I think we ended with this. We'll repeat it briefly. The Malbim says something amazing. The Malbim says that what was going on was something else. Barak is going to come, and he's going to want to search. Right? He comes, this is a woman's tent. Before searching a woman's tent, he wants to know, are there any men home? If she says yes, he'll come in and search. If she says no, he won't enter the tent. He's not going to enter a woman's tent if there are no men around. And we're talking about a man who's in war, right? He's chasing a dangerous enemy. But the Malbim says, Sisera knew Jewish nature so well, he knew the way they operated, that yes, dangerous enemy and all, he would not enter a woman's tent if there's no man around.
She's outside, why can't he go in?
What's that?
If she is outside.
I don't know if she would stay outside. He was not going to get himself into a compromising situation.
He was alone?
Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I don't know. Okay. Fine. So he's shaking and quaking under the blanket, and she is ostensibly standing outside and holding forth. Vatikach Ya'el Eishes Chever. Now look at this again. We called her before a petite woman. Right? What she did, as she sad her oil, she took in her hand the stake of the tent. They used to have huge stakes, spikes, that they drove into the ground, that they tied the tent to, that she'd be able to withstand strong winds. So we're talking about a very heavy duty stake. Vatosem es hamakeves biyado. And she took a hammer in her hand, a sledgehammer. Vatovei elov balot. And she approached him quietly. Vatitka es hayoseh berakosoi. And she banged that spike right into his head, into his temple. Vatitznach ba'oretz. Went in so hard that it got embedded in the ground underneath. Went straight through, split his head. Ve'on yodam vayo'af. But he was already completely asleep at the time. He was out of it by Yomois, and he died instantly. So here, Chazal, note something very interesting here. Wouldn't it have been more neat to use a knife or a sword or something? His sword was there. Or it could have been other things. That's the way. Is that a feminine way to kill? Right? Took a spike and drove it into his head with a hammer? It seems to be the messiest way to do it, and also the most risky way. Mepharshim say she had a hard time with it. It was heavy, and she was a woman. Chazal say something amazing. Yes, that was a more feminine way to kill. A sword, a pialocha, is considered a male article. And she was not going to take a sword in hand, because it's a lack of tzlius. You hear that? We just saw before everything that was going on here. Right? She had seduced him. Married woman. 7 times she egged him on. And now, she's not going to pick up a sword because that's a manly thing. Men don't kill with spikes and hammers, and therefore that's how she did it. So we have to note something very, very important here. We're going to discuss this more later when we get to how Devorah relates to all this whole story, the concept of Ya'el, her Avera Lishma. But we have to note that Ya'el, with everything she did not for a moment let go of her spiritual standards. She did what she deemed necessary to do. She felt that it was necessary for the sake of saving Klal Yisrael to seduce him. Not once, not twice, but 7 times. To ensure that she'd be able to do what she needs to do. Outside of that, she wasn't going to deviate in the slightest from the finest nuances of halacha. Wasn't necessary. She didn't feel that she needed to take a sword and kill him. He was out enough that she could do it this way. Or even more than that, we might say. The truth is, we have to note something here. Often a person is in a situation where you feel that the circumstances justify, right? Oynes, mikoach nefesh, whatever it is. And therefore, sometimes a person just lets go completely. Right now I can't take halacha into account. Look at Ya'el. In a situation where she's doing the worst things in halacha, you would think that it should at least lessen her sensitivities a little. Her sensitivities were at the top place. Right? Her sensitivities of tzniyus, of female behavior, were untouched at all. And therefore, she kept even this fine inyan of properness. Even though, probably, al pi halacha, she would have been allowed to take a sword. Just make sure it gets done. But, no, it wasn't just that she said, free for all, 7 times, why not? No, 7 times because it needed to be 7 times for our purposes. We'll see, there's actually more depth to that. We'll get there later. Again, we're mainly going to address this in the main parish. But right now, we're just picking up on this nuance. This was one of them. She transgressed one of the averas that a person should give up his life rather than transgress. This was very extreme. Now her cheshbon was that give up your life is one thing, but when it's an issue of saving Klal Yisrael, it's permitted, which is the same cheshbon basically that Esther made. We'll see. Esther did the same thing. She was a married woman. She lived with Ahasuerus. Generally, she didn't have a choice. But on that time that Mordechai sent her to him, that meant that she was now coming and initiating the process. But we'll get to that. We're going to discuss that. If it's about this, I want to wait for the next paragraph. But what I'm getting at is this point, that all of that did not. Again, usually when we're in this sort of situation, our sensitivities drop. Right now we're on a different level. No, not in our case. We're going to see soon. We're talking about a woman who, with this whole little story, put herself on a very, very great level. Avera and all. But we'll see. Again, we're going to let the Avera deal with it later. Right now we're just discussing what happened. Now, Vehine, by the way, I'll just note one point. This is a point that Rabbi Benel makes. This we're going to see soon. We'll see later. It might take us a week or two to get there. The Vaira is going to have very great praise for what she did. Now let's forget the details of what she did. But Lamaisa, she saved Klal Yisrael, right? But Rabbi Benel is just another question. Forget what we just discussed. But just from a moral perspective, we're talking about a man who came to her because he knew that this is a place where he has friendship. Right? We said, he shalayim bein yavin lebein chevet beis chevet akein. He came to her, he put his life in her hands because he knew that this is a family that's friendly with us. These are what we call from our people. Right? Is the way she acted, can that be justified from the ethical standpoint? So obviously, the answer is that again, when you're talking about saving Klal Yisrael, trickery is another. A sword is a weapon. A spear is a weapon. Trickery is also a weapon. When you're at war, you're at war. Spies do that. Nobody has ethical questions on spies. But Rabbi Benel said something very interesting. He said she solved that problem too. When she seduced him, and he accepted, was that loyalty to his friend Chever Akeni? Was that loyalty to his friend Chever? Absolutely not. When she came and made her suggestions to him and he took her up, he was stepping out of any framework of friendship between him and Chever Akeni. He was basically saying, now, he's taking his relationship with her somewhere else. Oh, once you start with a woman, you don't know where you're going to go. Right? This was already independent. This was clearly outside the framework of his friendship with Chever. On the contrary, he had just betrayed Chever in the worst way possible. If he was a friend, he should have said, "Hey, Yael, no, I can't do that. Hide me and that's all." Sisera wasn't the type. Okay? Fine. He wasn't the type. But now there's already no more tightness of friendship and trust. Going off with this woman, you're putting your fate in her hands? Who knows what she's going to do? You can't rely on women. That was her cheshbon. This is what the Abba Benel implies. But fine. As I said, more analysis on this little incident we're going to see in the Shira, in the Vayera Shira, where she really gives the whole prophetic analysis on everything that happened here. What's that? Yes. If there was a family, the Canaan were the family of Yisra. They were the family of Yisra. They were separate. They lived separately from the Jewish people, but they were Gerim. You see that they actually learned in the yeshiva of Asniel ben Knaz. Api Alokha, they were Jewish. Just that in those times it was especially pronounced that at the end of the day they were something, a different strain, because they didn't have a regular Nachara. But they were full-fledged Jews. Now, the name Barak Redefes Sisra. Meanwhile, Barak is chasing Sisra. Vateitzeya Eli Krasai. And now Yael steps back out of the tent once again. And she comes out to meet him. And she told him, Lech ve'areka es ha'ish asher ata mevakesh. You want to see the man you're looking for? I know where he is. And he came. And there was Sisera collapsed, dead, v'hayoseh berakosoy, with the spike in his head. No. Here it's just technical.
Now, why was it necessary for her to commit to sitting being with him in order to kill him if he was defeated, exhausted, and there were Jewish men all around?
Well, she wanted to make sure he was exhausted enough. As long as Sisera was alive, the whole situation was dangerous. Meaning, as we saw last week, Sisera was a very capable guy. And as long as he was alive, the war was not won. They wiped out the whole army, but as long as he could be alive and he can get away, and he was capable, right? Every added half hour that Sisera was alive, you don't know where he's going to end up. And we're talking about a person who's more elite than the elite commandos, right? He could go and rebuild the whole army and we'll be back to square one. So she had to kill him. She felt that, and she was right, that it was imperative to get the job done as soon as possible. Could be that otherwise, by the time Barak showed up, he would have been long gone. We don't know. And she, in order for this to work...
Let him nap for 5 minutes and go.
Right. And in order for this to work, she wanted to make sure that he was as exhausted as possible. She wanted him to be at a level of unconsciousness that she brought him to. Right? So, that plus the milk did the job. Now, Vayachna Elohim b'yom ahu es yovin melech Kanaan lifnei b'nei Yisrael. And Hashem subdued on that day Yavin, the king of Canaan, before the Jewish people. Vatelech yad b'nei Yisrael holoich v'koshal Yavin melech Canaan. Now all of a sudden the tables were turned around. Now the Jewish people started oppressing Yavin and the Canaan more and more. Ad asher hichrisu es Yavin melech Canaan. Until they completely destroyed Yavin, the king of Canaan. He was only based on this Sisera. Once Sisera was gone, Yavin was gone too. And on the contrary, we see here that this was not like in previous cases where they earned their salvation and then they slipped again. The virus hold at this point, her influence was this, at this point was very strong, and therefore from then on their success just went and intensified, because the Jewish people, Taka, kept up to par all throughout her days. Now, as I said, we started discussing the other week, and we're really going to see that emphasized now. We have to appreciate the magnitude of what we just saw here. What we just saw was completely not like anything that had happened up till now. Othniel had wars, Ehud ben Shamgar, fine. But what happened now was something that Chazal Mamish put on the caliber of Kriyas Yamsu and of Yeshua stopping the sun. This was a battle of 10 to 40,000 unarmed men. We'll see soon who they were. These were not warriors. Who did he get out to war? School teachers. They came out with the rulers, ready to take on the Canaanim. Right? 10 to 40,000 men taking on the strongest army in the world. Right? This was an Es Hanukkah, many fold. Taking on the strongest army in the world, who actually had forces from all the armies in the world with him. Right? And as we saw before, it's not that Barak fought them and beat them. Barak did not fight. Hashem came, completely creamed Sisera's army. All Barak had to do was chase them and help them fall. That's what we saw last week. Basically, that was his job. He ran after them and killed them. But we saw last week that first of all, Hashem made, they heard from all directions as though there were big armies attacking them, and it just caused absolute panic in the camp. Then we said that the stars changed position, burned up heated up the armor until they were scalded, and they jumped into the Kishon, which was normally a placid creek. All of a sudden the Kishon turned into a violent river and simply swept them away. This is what was going on here. What Mamish is seeing, the way she's going to describe it soon, they saw the heavens battling Sisera. So this was an event of the magnitude Mamish of Kriyas Yamsu. And it was also a shock, we're going to see soon. The whole thing was just like a complete shock. Last thing they knew, they were under this reign of terror of this superpower army that was basically controlling all of Eretz Yisrael. All of a sudden, the whole army is gone. Right? And we're going to see soon. Last week, we saw that for Barak to go around trying to get the army was considered miraculous. The challenge was, would he be able to scrape together 10,000 people? Many people told him he's nuts, right? He had to come, in order to have a chance for this to work, he had to go around with the Vayra, personally, that they should see the cheese behind him, and even so, they couldn't get everybody out. Right? So, it was considered miraculous that they got those 10,000 people out. Others, as we'll see soon, were looking on skeptically, or even more than that. We'll see described soon. Now, there was other Shvatim who were kind of like looking on in a very skeptical way. We'll see. But the next thing you know is, again, this ragtag group of school teachers, that's it, it's finished. The army is gone. And now all of a sudden, all of Eretz Yisrael changed, all reality of Eretz Yisrael changed. The Jews regained Eretz Yisrael. That formidable army simply is no more. So this was, the impact was immense. And therefore we have now, it follows in the same way as after Kriyas Yam Suf, we had Moshe saying Shira, after the sun stopped at Givon, we had Yeshua, and now, Vatosha Devoira, begin Parakei, and Devoira sang, Ubarak ben Avinoyam, and Barak ben Avinoyam, Bayem Ahu Leimor, on that day sang. Now we just note, Devoira did not get up with a microphone and sing for the Jewish people, she was a woman after all. So that's why it's worded this way. Vatosha Devoira means Devoira sang. It doesn't say that they sang together. It's not plural and it's in the female. Vatosha Devoira, Devoira alone sang. And also Barak ben Avinoyam. What that means was that she expressed the song and he actually conveyed it. Bayem Ahu Leimor. What?
You heard her singing?
No. The Shiva with the words. How he sang it, he sang it. Maybe he did hear her. We saw that he was her husband, according to... Yeah. I mean, some Mepharshim say that there might be a possibility otherwise, but again, simply understood he actually was her husband, so it's possible that she did actually give him the tune too. Whatever it is, he was the one broadcasting it. Now, this Shira we're going to pay a lot of attention to. And not only that, I think we're going to go through it twice, because... this shira is expressed on two levels. It's expressed on the material level and on the spiritual level, meaning there's always the way things play out externally, physically, and then there's the underlying spiritual significance behind them. We're going to go through this shira seeing both levels. We'll see, Bezos Hashem. Meaning the shira is going to be describing how this happened and that happened. Yenus and Benaziel and goes through the whole Shira describing the spiritual mechanics of what was going on, what caused what, etc. So we'll see. But first we're going to go through it on what I guess we'll call the more simple level, which is also not so simple. So now when the stability of Yisrael was threatened, was breached. The Prayer of Prayers means was disrupted. The stability of Yisrael was disrupted. And the nation dedicated itself to war. We have to bless Hashem. Meaning the first thing she's expressing is that the miracles began, yet before the war even started. The fact that 10,000 people managed, that 10,000 people did come out of this war is already miraculous in and of itself. It was so ridiculous. It was so stupendous that 10,000 people should come and challenge Sisera's army, that that's already the first miracle that we have to bless Hashem for. Okay, so now the Mepharshim stress a couple of other points. Before I approach B'Yisrael, there's another thing that we're thanking Hashem for. And this is something that we have to appreciate in a general way. This is the way it's supposed to work. Before I praise be Israel, when Hashem, this is, other Mepharshim explained it as follows. When Hashem exacts his revengeance through the Bnei Yisrael, meaning, yes, Hashem came to war, but he said, I want Barak and his army there at least giving some sort of semblance of doing this war. And therefore, as we saw before, they were attributed with the victory. Right? So Hashem, we have to note this, when Hashem does his vengeance, he does it through the Jewish people. The Jewish people are the ones who actually bring it out. And this is also something to bless Hashem for. What does that mean? What that means is, Hashem wants to show his might in this world. Or Hashem shows his greatness. How does he show his greatness? Through the Jewish people. Now, when we are living the way Hashem wants us to live, right? The way the Jews lived back in the period of the Bais Rishon, existence in Eretz Yisrael was unnatural. The rest of the world ran according to nature. Existence in Eretz Yisrael was unnatural. This was something that was recognized by the nations worldwide. They knew that the Jews have a God who's above and beyond everyone else. They believed in all kinds of other gods, but they acknowledged Hashem as the mightiest God of all, as the most powerful God of all, and as the most capable God of all. Because they saw that the Jewish people, on all levels, military, financial, etc., live on a miraculous level, on a supernatural level. Now, what's the idea of this? The idea of this is because Hashem wants to show His glory to the rest of the world. But He chooses us as the means of showing it. In other words, if we'll put it this way, we're His ambassadors in this world. We are here to represent Hashem's oneness. When we do it right, Hashem shows His greatness through us by granting us unbelievable successes. We are the vehicles of showing Hashem's greatness in this world. That's what we say, for example, right? Maral says, Hashem Echad. Really, everything is ultimately meant to teach that Hashem Echad. Meant to see it in everything that happens in the world, Hashem's oneness. The Jewish people are meant to be the manifestation of that. That's why the Jewish people are 13 Shvatim. 13 is the Gematria Echad. Okay, you know, that's a little philosophical. Let's get back to the virus song. Shimu Melachim Ha'azinu Roizni. Listen, kings. Listen, governors. Meaning, listen to this carefully. Before you consider fighting the Jewish people again, listen to what happened here. Anechila Hashem. I am dedicated to Hashem. And therefore, Anechi Ashira. Therefore, I am now going to sing. Azamro la Hashem Elikei Yisrael. I'm going to sing to Hashem, the God of Israel. Meaning, don't make any mistakes here. We have to make it as clear as possible and articulate clearly that this whole story was simply a miracle. And therefore, since I'm dedicated to Hashem, I attribute everything to Hashem. Anything that happens in my life, I attribute to Hashem. And therefore, that's what I'm about to do now. We are going to simply restate the whole story from that perspective, attributing it to Hashem. Now, we just have another indication of the various greatness in this pasuk too. Chazal say, there are two anoichi stated here. Anoichi la Hashem, anoichi Ashira. I am to Hashem, I will sing. Where did this battle take place? It took place around Har Tavar, we saw. Anybody remember the name Har Tavar from other contexts? Har Tavar was one of the candidates, one of the ones running for Matan Torah. Whatever it means, I don't know exactly. But Har Tavar wanted to have, there were three candidates in the elections. Har Tavar, Har Carmel, and Har Sinai. Har Sinai won. But Hashem told Har Tavar, again, we're not going to get into what all this means that mountains wanted. Har Tavar wanted to have the Torah given on it, and apparently it had merit. So Hashem told Har Tavar, you missed now, but I'm going to pay it back to you even more. When did this happen? Now in the time of Devarim. On Har Sinai, Anoichi was said only once. Anoichi Hashem Elokeinu. On Har Tavar, Anoichi was said twice. So Hashem paid Har Tavar back with good measure. That's what Chazal say. So that's what's expressed here. Anoichi la Hashem, Anoichi Ashira. Now there's an obvious question here. A very obvious question. What kind of payback is that? What kind of payback is that? Who's the Anoichi on Har Sinai? Anoichi Hashem Elokeinu. Who's the Anoichi on Har Tavar? What happens if I right, get up on the top of Dolev and yell Anoichi three times? I am Binyamin Jacobson. So that's it. You know, it will say that this mountain outdid the two of them. It's got three Anoichis. What sort of payback is that? So Rav Dessler says something amazing. He says, no, Devorah's Anoichi, we've already seen earlier that Devorah reached levels of prophecy that were reminiscent of Moshe Rabbeinu. That the people before, the great leaders before us, Niel ben Knaz and Ehud ben Gera, were not at. We saw to the extent that when she prophesied, she was surrounded with flames. We even saw those that say that her prophecy was on such an ongoing level that she separated from her husband, the same way Moshe did. Whatever it is, we're talking about a prophet on a very, very unique caliber among prophets. Asnael ben Kenaz and Eod ben Gera. So, what Rav Dessler says here is something that Nefesh HaChaim says about Moshe Rabbeinu. She so negated her personality, she became such a conduit of Hashem's presence that everything about her just bespoke Hashem. Just like we say about Moshe Rabbeinu, not on the same level. Nobody reached that level that Moshe Rabbeinu did. But that Moshe Rabbeinu was simply a transparent representation of what Hashem was. Anything Moshe Rabbeinu said was the word of Hashem. It's to the extent that even his facial expressions were construed by the Jewish people as expressing what Hashem is feeling. When they saw Moshe made a face, they understood that Hashem was displeased. If they saw Moshe smiling, they understood that Hashem was pleased. The Rambam says that at length. Everything about Moshe, he brought his personality to just merge with Hashem so much that there was nothing that you could define as Moshe. It was simply Hashem shining through it. And therefore, wherever Moshe went, you saw the honor of Hashem. Dvorah reached that level too. Now, I won't say that level too. Dvorah reached such a level where Dvorah was simply a manifestation of Hashem. And when she got up there and she said, Anoichi, Anoichi, it was actually, in a sense, a revelation of Hashem.
Like a skin of the
something like that. Yeah. Yeah. That's why, for example, Chaim Volozhin says, V'nachnu ma, right? Moshe Rabbeinu said, V'nachnu ma, Kairach had tainus on Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu says, what am I? Chaim Volozhin says, it's not just an expression. Moshe Rabbeinu meant it very literally. There's nothing here. There's nothing here. It's just Hashem. Anything I say is just Hashem. Anything he expressed, anything about him was just Hashem. So V'nachnu ma, there's someone called Moshe here? There's nobody here. Shachan takes it a step further. This is that you might think it's a joke, but he says it very seriously. He says Aaron wasn't really on that level. Nobody reached that level of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu said, "Nachnu, what are we?" He said it just in order to show respect for Aaron. Aaron really wasn't really ma. He wasn't really nothing. Only Moshe was nothing. But Moshe said out of respect for Aaron, he said "Nachnu ma." Okay, but whatever it is, this is what's being expressed here also. Now she starts talking. This is the preamble, right? Now she starts talking. Hashem b'teischom yiseir b'tzadchom yisei adoim eretz roasho gam shomoyim not tofu gam ovim not fumoyim. She says, Hashem, when you marched forth from the fields of Edom, from Seir, when you came forth from Seir, when you came forth from Edom, the land quaked, the heavens dripped, the clouds all dripped water. Meaning, what's going on? Saying that he came, we're talking about Matan Torah. When you gave the Torah, the entire world quaked. So we know. When Hashem came down on Har Sinai, earth couldn't handle it. Right? The earth, it says the mountains were shaking. What was going on there? What was going on was that the presence of the Shekhinah was too much for the physical world to handle. The world was falling apart. That's what was going on. That's what happened at Har Sinai. But Gam Shamayim Not Fumayim. She says also the heavens dripped. And also, clouds dripped with water. What's she saying here? What she's saying is as follows. Any of the miracles that we're seeing now is actually the result of the heavens dripping back at Har Sinai. What's that mean? That means it's as follows. What happened at Har Sinai? What happened at Har Sinai really was that the world was starting to function. The world was created in 6 days, but that's the physical world. The world wasn't really considered finished. It wasn't plugged in until the Jews actually got the Torah. The world is meant to function on Torah, right? On the Jews observing the Torah. That's really the world functioning. The Jews observing the Torah. The world was plugged in and really started operating then at Har Sinai. The way this is expressed by Rashi and by the Targum is that at Har Sinai the heavens drift, meaning what they call the Talat Chiyah started coming down. The heavens dripped with this spiritual water that came down and saturated the earth and allowed the earth to really start growing, right? Rashi and the Targum are not going to express it the way I did. It was plugged in. They express it a different way. The world was first watered then. That was when the world really started working. Up till then, the world wasn't really working. Meaning, the world really is the Jewish people performing the Torah and Hashem responding. Anything that happens around the world is really revolving around the Jewish people. sometimes in more far out ways, sometimes in more direct ways. But that's what's really going on. And therefore she's saying, everything that we just saw now, right? The stars being rearranged, the armor becoming red hot, the river becoming violent, you know what that is? That's that plug in at Har Sinai, right? The heavens dripped. The earth was watered, and this is what's sprouting forth now. This is the result of the Jews being plugged into Hashem, the Jews' relationship with Hashem, and the Jews' relationship with Hashem manifests in this way. It manifests with the greatest army in the world being completely wiped out. So she says, again, we're talking about prophetic analysis. Get the right perspective. You know what you're seeing now? You're seeing the effect at Har Sinai. At Har Sinai, it could be that the Jews didn't quite get what this actually meant. But at Har Sinai, the world was watered. What was it watered with? These types of events that we're seeing now. And then she continues. She says, "Hari nazlu mipnei Hashem." Mountains melted away before Hashem. Zeh Sinai, right? For example, Sinai was quaking and shaking. Mipnei Hashem elekei Yisrael. Before Hashem elekei Yisrael. In other words, what happened then was so awesome. Up till then, the world was basically dormant. Until the Torah was given, the world was dormant. It was kind of waiting for things to start. That's why Chazal say, when Hashem created the world in the first place, He said, yeah, but everything's on hold, pending, on condition, until Har Sinai. If the Jews accept the Torah, then the world will run. If not, not. So the way Chazal put it is like the world wasn't really finalized until then. Then the world was finalized. But at that point, the revelation of Hashem was so awesome with all the events surrounding it, right? The splitting of the sea, the Jews going into Eretz Yisrael was so awesome that the whole world shook. It shook the entire world. You see at the Kriyas Yamsuf that it says everyone around the world was quaking. And when the Jews actually came into Eretz Yisrael, the entire world was quaking. The entire world was at awe at everything they were seeing. And therefore at that time, the Jews were simply considered untouchable. It was scary to touch the Jews. And that's what we see, that kind of like Amalek came to try to change that dynamic. But basically the idea was, the Jews were just scary. There was an awe around them. And when they came into Eretz Canaan, it was very, very scary. Like the Rachel described, everybody was just melting away. It was frightening. But she says, so that was the state when we came into Eretz Yisrael. But unfortunately all that changed. It didn't take a long time for the Jews to become very invincible. Is that how you say it? I don't know if the opposite of invincible is vincible. But whatever it is, it didn't take a long time before the nation saw that, you know what? Jews are not that scary after all. Vulnerable, yeah. They, as soon as spiritual decline started setting in, the awesome aura around the Jews started dropping. And the nations around started saying, no, you can pick on the Jews. And you can even pick on them a little more. Until it reached situations where other nations gained control over areas of Eretz Yisrael. Whether for a short time, in the days of Asniel it was a little bit, in the days of Ehud it was a little bit more, they fought them back. But already they were saying that, okay, yeah, the Jews had very, very big periods, very glorious periods, but they relaxed, and therefore Hashem's providence also relaxed. And now we can mess with them. That whole awe was basically undone. Shame, right? So now she says, yes, Bimei Shamgar ben Anos, in the days of Shamgar ben Anos, Bimei Yael, in the days of Yael, Chodlu Arachos. Yes, it reached the situation where that Jewish might and that whole aura slowly sank until it reached rock bottom. Jews had to stop traveling in open roads. People who did want to travel the roads had to go on these big roundabout detours. That's what was going on in the days of Sisera. That reached rock bottom.
What does that mean?
From the glory. What's that? It means that they had to take these, you know, through the forest and unknown paths. If they would travel on the open roads, they were likely to be attacked and ambushed. It wasn't safe. Well, none of Eretz Yisrael was safe. They had to sneak through the forest if they wanted to go from one city to another. So, yeah, from the glorious days of Kriyas Yamsu, right? Of Hashem leading His people of entering by Eretz Yisrael by splitting Yericha and stopping the sun, they reached a situation where Jews couldn't travel the streets freely. Chadlu prozoin b'Yisrael, chadelu. Yes, not only open roads, but even open cities simply ceased. Jews could no longer live in simply cities. See, in open cities, they moved into walled cities. Ad shakamti devayra, shakamti aim b'Yisrael, until I arose, devayra, and I arose like a mother to the Jewish people. Meaning, in other words, what she's saying is like this. We have to understand, here she's bringing home again the significance of what happened here. Basically, the Jews had reached a situation of, the Jews were once a great people, that's over. Right? Started dropping, days of Kushan Rishasayim, Egoi Melech Moab, and days of Sisera, that was it. Eretz Yisrael was basically controlled. It was a nice story, it was nice while it lasted. They had, I don't know if it was 50, it wasn't 50 years, about 100 years of a nice period. That's it, it's finished. It's a thing of the past. Now Sisera reigns Eretz Yisrael, and the Jews are just another nation being oppressed by him. That's all, finished. What's that?
Canaanite oppression.
Yeah, 20 years. Yeah. Until, she says, in my time, the Jewish people were reborn. I'm like a mother who bore them anew. Meaning the Jews came back to life. The whole previous situation was restarted, was reinstated anew. I mean, in other words, yes, these events that happened in the days of Dvoira were a repetition of Kriyas Yamsuf, which created the same effect and brought the Jews back to that same position after it had completely finished. It was a new birth. Now Chazal and Isa take issue with the way Dvoira expressed herself. Dvoira said, yes, in the days of Shamgar ben Anos, in the days of Yael, by the way, before you know from that apparently Yael was already an old leader before him, but whatever it is, yeah, things deteriorated until I arose as a mother in Klal Yisrael. As I'll say, ooh, that has a conceited sound.
As a what?
That has a conceited sound. We'll see soon that the Vayra on her great level paid for this in her way. But right now we'll put that on hold. Now, Yivchar, so now she describes what's been going on here. Yivchar Elohim Chadoshim. Sorry, Yivchar Elohim Chadoshim. Why was it that it reached this lowly state? When the Jewish people choose new gods? Oz Lachem Sha'arim. Then, yes, every city becomes a fight. As soon as they start dropping the standards, every city becomes a fight. As soon as they repented, meaning, under the influence and under the inspiration of Dvaira, all of a sudden everything changed. But then when they repented, it went to the extreme opposite. You didn't even see swords or spears or shields among the 40,000 who were fighting Sisera. We had a small group of 40,000 fighting Sisera. No spears or shields were seen. Like we said before, they came out, the school teachers came out with pencils ready to stab. Okay, I just want to end with one comment. Where did the 40,000 come from? We weren't talking about 40,000 up till now. What? Before we said 10. Right, where did 40,000 come from? So this we already alluded to last week, but the truth is that initially Hashem said, I have to see 10,000 people dedicating themselves in order for me to do it. But others did join. Meaning Barak reached the required quota of 10,000, but others joined. It ended up with 40,000. 40,000 is a very small percentage of Klal Yisrael, and so we'll see Dvorah's comments on the others, on the 41,000. We'll see. But Lamai said there were 40,000 people fighting, and if you looked at it, you saw them fighting the big army of Sisera, no shields or spears. So look at the difference of when the Jews are loyal, when they are up to Hashem's standards, and when they're not. Okay? We'll stop here for this week.